seconds with last couple minutes has been about basically level of evidence. The study design is an indication of the level of evidence, okay? So let's talk a little bit more about level of evidence. Here is the Oxford Center for Evidence-Based Medicine levels of evidence as of May 2001 for therapy kinds of things. If you had to read through your paper and try and determine whether this is a level 1A, level 1B, level C, you would give yourself a migraine pretty darn quickly. As a clinician, I expect you to throw this out, okay? This is not what the objective is when you've got a short period of time to be able to do it, but I wanted to show you, I have to show you the end of the spectrum, right? So you can now write over that pass, okay?
Well, the other point there, is that sometimes articles will actually say, like
very,
when you're summarizing articles, what level of evidence.
Yeah.
And that's good.
More so now, but pretty rarely before 2005.
Right.
But if you want to say your point was well taken, that some articles will say, when they're doing a review of lit, they'll say there's level 2B evidence to support this intervention. Now at least you have a slide to refer to what 2B means, okay? 2B or not 2B. Okay, there are so many hierarchies. I could have chosen as I weeded through them all and tried to decide what was the best, what was the most relevant, what was the most useful. Suffice to say, there was a paper in 2003 by this gentleman, Upshur, and basically said that, you know, there's so many inconsistencies in the hierarchies themselves that, you know, the aim of evidence-based practice is to reduce unnecessary inconsistencies, and the variety of hierarchies actually increases the level of inconsistencies. And some, you know, if you ask me a question, should I throw out this paper just because it doesn't have a directional hypothesis? Like, how big a problem is that? Different hierarchies rate different sections differently. Okay, so that's why I've given you just questions to consider. So the principle that I am espousing here is that we use what makes sense in a clinical setting. We'll keep it simple, okay? And for that reason, and this is what I presented at the last workshop, I suggest you use this hierarchy. You get no more complicated than this, although there's plenty of ways of getting complicated. And basically, if it says meta-analysis, it's up at the top. You feel good about it. You can set your limits in your acquiring for a meta-analysis. Then systematic review, then narrative review, then clinical practice guidelines, then randomized controlled trials, then cohort studies, case-controlled studies, case studies, and expert opinion at the very bottom. Okay? So this is combined both from Cormack in 2002, as well as some other sources. But I think if you use this as your working guideline for rating the level of evidence, it's a really good start, okay? It's a solid start, okay? Any questions about that? Yes?
Sorry, in this one here that you didn't hear last time, you have narrative reviews.
I know, we're gonna go over that.
Okay.
Good question. The question was, in the last time I did this from Cormack, last time I put Cormack, today I wrote modified from Cormack. So because as I was weeding through all this stuff, I thought, but what if you come across an expert opinion paper? Where would you add it? Mm-hmm. What if you came across a narrative review paper? Where would you add it?
You're going to tell us what a narrative review is?
Yes, absolutely. I'm going to tell you what it is. In fact, here we go. Okay, this is just to compare. So a meta-analysis is basically, you have a whole bunch of randomized controlled trials, you have very strict methodological scoring of those papers, but they all have to have similar outcome measures. Okay, so that means that you can't compare a paper that looked at return to work with a paper that looked at range of motion, because they're different outcome measures, okay? When you do that, you pool the results statistically, and you end up with a statistical analysis. And that's your highest level of evidence. If on the other hand, you have randomized controlled trials, and you rate them all. You have a strict methodological scoring system. But the outcomes are variable. You can't pool the results. And that's what a systematic review is. So in comparison, meta-analysis, similar outcome measures, pool the results, you get a statistical final number. With a systematic review, randomized controlled trials, but they've got different outcomes, so you can't pool the results together statistically. Is that clear? So then what is a narrative review? Funny that you should ask. Makes me think that I was thinking in the right order here. In a narrative review, basically, it's a selection of articles, but it's not, you don't review those articles with a strict methodological scores. It's more like somebody collecting a whole bunch of papers together and saying, 6 of these 10 papers showed that there was a favorable outcome, 4 of the 10 showed that there wasn't a favorable outcome. The evidence to date thus suggests that there's probably greater likelihood of a favorable outcome than a non-favorable outcome.
So what's the difference between that and a literature review?
It's basically a lit review.
But it
okay.
has some...
But it's a less strong lit review than a systematic analysis.
Yes.
And the strongest lit review is the meta-analysis. Okay? Is that clear with everybody?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so meta-analysis down to a systematic review, down to a narrative review. Okay? Now, having said that, one of the problems with simplifying things is there's places where that might not fit. So is a systematic review always better than a randomized controlled trial? Maybe not. But I had to put it somewhere in the hierarchy. It's kind of fluffy between them. Maggie, do you want to comment on that?
No,
okay. So let's look at the strength of evidence. So we talked about level of evidence, meaning by study design. Is it a meta-analysis? Is it a systematic review? Is it a narrative review? Is it a clinical practice guideline? Is it an RCT? Is it a controlled study? Et cetera, so on. Okay, what we were talking about, that's level of evidence. Now we want to look at the strength of that level of evidence. Okay, it's paring down to a different level. I love this quote from Trish Granholm, who said, if you're deciding whether a paper is worth reading, you should do so on the design of the method section and not on the interest of the hypothesis, not on the nature or impact of the results, or on the speculation in the discussion. The meat is in the methods. I don't care that much if you don't read the results that well. But really, as a clinician, to know whether this is a good strength of evidence for you, you should read the methods. So guess what we're going to do? We're going to read the methods. Okay, there are numerous scales for strength of evidence. Physios might be familiar with the Pedro scale, okay, physiotherapy evidence-based. It's kind of like OT Seeker. We have Pedro, but we get a number where they've scored that paper for their methodology. Was there randomization? Was there et cetera, so on, okay? So, recognizing that there's many, and this is the most recent one from Susan Harris from UBC on a paper that looked at lymphedema, I believe. You can see that their ranking, they looked at 9 things. Was there randomization? Was there inclusion and exclusion criteria? And basically, you total them up, and the paper was strong if there were 8 to 10 yeses, moderate if there were 6 to 7, and weak if there was equal to or less than 5. The problem is that this scale doesn't relate to all papers across PT and OT. So I put it up there in case you get a paper that's relevant to it. But I think it's better that we think only in terms of questions rather than trying to decide what number out of 10 it is. Just to sort of, you know, the critical thinking stuff. So back to, like we did for the study purpose and the lit review, it's better to look at questions, I think, okay? So let's dig a little deeper. As you can see, I knew there were a lot of PEDS people here today, and I hope that you appreciate that I searched the web for kid pictures. We try to keep it consistent the whole way through because you rarely get
kids.
Sorry?
These are your kids.
No, no. Last, those of you that were at the last workshop, you almost saw a Family Home movie play at one point in it, so I decided I would keep my own kids out of the picture. Okay, so first of all, we look at the sample. Was there a detailed description? Did they give their age, their gender, the duration of the disease or the disability? Were the number reported? How many people there were? Were the groups equal and similar? Should they be stratified? I'll get into these questions in a minute. And was there a description of how subjects were sampled and recruited? So, first of all, let's look at the first question. Let's say we're only looking at age, and you read the methods section, and it said that the people were between, say, 19 to 64 years old, and the mean was, say, 52. Is that the kind of information that you're interested in? What does that tell you? It tells you that the average is 52. It tells you that the range is between 19 and 64. But what doesn't it tell you?
Where the numbers?
How skewed? What was the distribution like? And that's what you need the median for. The median tells you which is the most commonly occurring number. Okay? Now, you take an example, something like that of heart rate. If you had heart rates varying between 84 and 160, just giving the mean of, say, 95, the mean alone is a very poor descriptor. So the first thing that you should look for in the description of the sample is that they give you more than just the mean. That's the take-home message for it. Can you see why, as we put those numbers up? The mean doesn't tell you really anything. And so how can you compare to your patient population? Okay? Were the numbers reported? Were the groups equal and similar? If you have a group that's going to be getting an intervention and a group that isn't, so let's look at wound healing, and we look at a particular type of mattress for OTs here, for example. Is there anything about the patients that were recruited to the study that you would like to know? Okay. And would you want all the heavy people on one type of mattress and all the light people on the other? Would that tell you how effective the mattresses were? No. So what are you looking for in the distribution of subjects to both groups? Sorry, say again. That's right. What you want, the answer there was homogeneity. You want to make sure that the groups are as equally representative of as many factors as possible, as equally divided. At baseline, they should be similar. How do you determine from the methods section that they're similar at baseline? What do you expect to see? Sometimes they do tell you. And they're not there to ask, so you can ask them. Usually they have a table comparing subjects at baseline. So what you want to see is not just group one and group two, and from group one listed in that table, they say the age, the mean is 47, and the mean here is 48. Would that tell you that they're similar at baseline? No, because we know that the mean is not representative at all. What would you like at the end of that table?
Some kind of statistical test.
Maybe a p-value, for example, that says at baseline there was no statistical difference between them.
In age, in weight, in...
In whatever the factors are. Okay, is that clear with everybody? Then, is there a description of how they were sampled or recruited? Why should that make a difference? Let's take our wound healing example. Why would that make a difference if you recruited, if everybody that was on the ward was included in the study, versus just the people that the surgeon picked? How would that make a difference?
Because
one might be mobile and the other one was paralyzed.
Right. So there'd be some sampling bias there, perhaps? He wanted to show that this was an effective intervention, so he only picked subjects that he thought would do well. Okay? So that's why you want to know recruiting. Okay, were there appropriate inclusion-exclusion criteria? So for example, did you want a group include, should there be times that you wouldn't include a particular portion of the population because it would make the results invalid, for example? Was there a justification, a sample size? How do they know? Your question. What is that magic number of how many subjects need to be there? This is what you're looking for, and Maggie's going to go into a little bit more detail in there. Somewhere they have to justify their sample size, and the key word is power. And Maggie's going to talk about power in a couple slides from now. Did they do a calculation of power? Okay. If there was more than one group, were they randomized? Was the allocation of which group they went into, was it concealed? Meaning, were they blinded? Did they know what they were getting? And were ethics procedures reported? Okay, based on that, if you have people that volunteer, they tend to do better than people that are referred. So if they're all volunteers in one group and all referred in the other, there would be some volunteer referral bias. If you were looking at diseases that vary with season, like cystic fibrosis exacerbations or COPD exacerbations, you'd want to see that the groups were equally divided over that term. And did they get the same amount of attention in both groups? So what I want you to know is break out into your groups, look at the sample part of the methods. Remember, the methods, that is your Bible to your importance in looking at the review and the appraising the article. So divide into your groups and just look at the sample. 5 minutes to read is demographics and inclusion criteria. Okay? Detailed description of the sample: age, gender, duration of disease, disability. Age and weight. How did you determine? What did they give you in the paper that let you know if they were equal at baseline?
They just gave means.
They gave means
with
p-values. Okay. So let's look at this. Is there any more information that you would like to have known about these people?
Yes.
You're nodding heads. Yell out what you would like to have known. Yes?
I'd like to know more about the demographics, not just that they're the same, but what was it?
Exactly. In terms of? Not just
maybe
age and weight,
education,
but...
education or where they lived.
Was English a first language so that they could understand the, same like the cognitive functioning that we alluded to before? Yes?
Level of function.
Level of function?
Mm-hmm. Socioeconomic status.
Socioeconomic status? Okay. They said that there's in the appendix, and if
yes.
you go back to the appendix, they did provide, but you'd have to go to that online. But that's where you'd really get more information about it. Were the numbers reported?
Yes.
Yes. Were they equal and similar? They tell us they're similar-ish, okay? Basically is what we know at this stage. What I mean by stratified is, do you think that there's some subgroups in here? Do you think that maybe they should have been divided into different cognitive levels, for example? Okay? So that if they had divided them into subgroups, would you have gotten better information? Just things to think about. Was there a description of how they were sampled or recruited?
Yes. Somewhat.
Yeah. How were they sampled and recruited? Basically, everybody that came across that was going to have it was asked.
Yeah.
And then if they fit within the inclusion and exclusion criteria, then it proceeded from there. That's the best way, okay, rather than looking for volunteers or strict referral. Okay? Were there appropriate inclusion and exclusion criteria? Is there anyone that you would have wanted excluded from this?
We just thought they weren't very clear.
So
in terms of the neuromuscular compromise. So
what
that
does neuromuscular compromise mean?
Yeah.
Okay, could you reproduce that? Does that reflect your patient caseload? Okay. What else?
The language, it would have been nice to have English speaking, speaking or all Chinese speaking, whatever, but at home, again, a group that you knew everybody understood.
Okay, yes, there was another hand.
I didn't understand what they meant when they said the exclusion criteria included blah, 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 hyperflexibility syndromes, et cetera, those different things. But then further down it says no patients were excluded for hyperflexibility, Alzheimer's, or Parkinson's.
They just meant that those were the original exclusion criteria for the study, but none of those patients fit those characteristics anyway.
Okay.
All right. Was there justification of sample size?
No.
Not in this part of the study. But later on as we read through, they do. So if you turn to study protocol, where is it? Maggie, help me.
It's at the very end.
Page
249.
Turn to page 249. Statistical analysis was performed with blah, 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 blah. In brackets, before the beginning of the study, a power analysis was performed with an alpha level of 0.05 and a beta set at 0.80. And with the use of historic dislocation rate at our institution of approximately 1.0 to detect a threefold difference in the dislocation rates. This analysis, you can go blah, 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 blah.
Thank you.
This one. This analysis indicates that a minimum of 260 hips, a minimum of 130 in each group would be needed to avoid a type 2 error. So they figured out how many patients they would need in order to make it statistically valid, I guess you could say. Okay? So they did, and we'll talk about that in a minute. Okay, hang in there. Maggie's coming. Okay? All right. Were they randomized into who received? Yes. Was allocation concealed? How can it be? You either see a horkin' big abduction pillow in bed, or you don't. You don't miss those kinds of things. So they couldn't conceal it. Yeah.
They said they concealed it to the point of after surgery, so
right,
there wasn't the surgical bias.
Right. But afterwards, if you're a nurse or a physio or an OT on that ward, and you know this study's going on, and there's patients with abduction pillows, you go, aha! I can figure out what group they're in, and I want this to show that all this stuff is ridiculous, and therefore I'll put, et cetera. There could be some bias. Yes.
They did say, though, that the people that were unrestricted could use the equipment if they desired for their comfort.
Yes.
So
we're
going to
talk about that.
There too.
That's called contamination, and we're going to talk about that. Good point. Okay? And were ethics procedures reported? Yes. Okay, so was there any volunteer or referral bias? No. Was there any seasonal bias? Other short of slipping on ice in winter, but okay. Was there attention bias? Did one group get more attention?
No.
A little bit.
Maybe. You got this big pillow in bed, somebody has to move it, but how do you control for that? So, Maggie, come up and address our power issue.
I just had a question. It said that risk aversion was one of the most common reasons for people not participating in the study. And I'm wondering where that would influence the sample.
Sure it would, because you have most people in there that aren't that frightened. Right? Would that affect your prevalence of dislocation? It's possible. But probably favors more the non-intervention. Right? The people with most precautions, they're the ones that are going to want the people that are most risk averse will want the most precautions. Okay.
Just moving on. So we talked about strength of the evidence, and we looked at different levels of evidence. And this is sometimes when you're looking at studies, you're going to say it in a different way. You're going to see sometimes they'll talk about phase studies. And they'll talk about phase one, phase two, and phase three. Very rarely will you they talk about phase four studies, but it just, we thought it'd be good for you to understand what do they mean about these phases of studies. And a lot of them refer to actually when you're looking at drugs, but you can also refer to when you're testing devices. And phase one is where you're looking mostly at tolerance, how does a person tolerate, it might be, you know, and safety issues. So what are the safety issues in saying introducing a new electrical stimulation machine? What are the adverse events? So you would have had also done some studies and could be in animals as well that they're doing it in, are just very small numbers of patients to try and read these out. Phase two was a study that I was just looking at, a multi-center study that I was involved in, and what it was an inhalation drug. And what they were looking in these phase two ones is the efficacy of it, and also just a more pilot study in terms of when you're looking at calculating the power to see if something is truly different effect, you need to know, well, how do we know how big is enough, how many people we need for it? So you can do these phase two studies, and they and you can help them to estimate how many people you're going to need for the big studies. And the big studies then we come on to are the phase three. And to get any drug into Canada or any devices into Canada, you have to go through these phases. So phase three is where you get the large numbers, you get multi-center studies, and they all have to be comparative trials, where you're going to maybe against the placebo, or because sometimes, as we said already, can be against nothing, but they're large randomized controlled trials for phase three. Phase four seeks to determine the negative side effects, and normally when people have got to phase three and got things that accepted, they very rarely go on to phase four. But you may see in a lot of studies are now saying what phase they are, in the what type of a study is in terms of phases. Okay, then moving on, this is a nice quote that's always by one of our epidemiologists, always has pointed this into my head, and it says, absence of evidence is no evidence of absence. So what basically that means to say is, the lack of evidence is not to say that there is no evidence and things. So a good example of this here is, if we had the danger in this is, and this is where we talk about type 2 errors. So the danger is, we want to compare treatment A to treatment B. And so we may use, say, your example of, you know, post-ICU, post-mobilized, the ICU patients, whether you want to head of the bed up, maybe treatment A, or mobilizing is treatment B. Okay, and then the outcome variable we'll use in yours is that the outcome variable may be the length of stay in ICU, as you said. Okay, and this shows no, so you've tested these two things, you've got half the patients randomized to stay in bed with the head of the bed up, and half you're mobilizing every day, and you're looking at the length of stay, and at the end of it, you see when you compare these two groups, there's no difference in length of stay. So what you may then report is the conclusion is that staying in bed is just as effective as mobilizing. Well, the truth is that you may not have had enough people to actually have seen that difference. So to, in order to ensure that, and this is called a type two error. So in order to ensure that, you know, that we have enough people, we have to do the power calculation before any study. So it infers that the two treatments are equally efficacious when they're not. And actually, this is a really good study that we're going to look in a little bit more detail, because they talk actually quite a bit about the type 2 errors. So they did a power analysis beforehand, and you read it all under statistical analysis, and you think, okay, you don't need to read this a lot in depth, but you need to know whether has it been done or not done before the study. Things you may want to know, level of significance was set at p equals 0.05, and that just means that you know, that it's looking at 95% of the, this was set at 95% of the people would fall within this. And then B set at 80%, meaning as you're applying in 80% of the situations. And this is, those are standard, 80% is basically the base level, so you don't really need to know any more than that. Then you need to know, okay, from your, if you're doing phase two studies, you would argue, look at your historical data, you'd want to know what is the rate of dislocations, and in this center they had looked at the historical data and saw that the rate of dislocation was 1%. This study also, it was not powered, the difference in this study was, it was not hard to show that there was no difference. It was actually hard to show a threefold difference, and that would be that the one group would be to show 3%, at least 3% of the number of dislocations compared to the 1%. So that was how the study was powered. And to do that, they said, okay, that they needed 260 people for this study. And that's really good that they've done this beforehand. Okay. But I want you just to read the next paragraph, just yourselves. Okay, just read the results. Just the next paragraph on page 249 and see what happens. Under results.
Prevalence of dislocation?
The prevalence of dislocation. And what was the prevalence of dislocation? Okay, there's just one word. The dislocation rate was 0.33%. So it wasn't even the 1%. It wasn't the one even 1%. So when you look at studies, and that's part of even being a study, the fact that you're in a study, you can have a placebo effect, and that means that because that you're in a study and you're being shown that little bit more follow-up by, even it might be that you're not being, having a phone call, maybe that you're just filling a questionnaire, you're just maybe more aware of things, then you'll usually see a change in the rate just because of that. So here we are, before the study, the rate was 1%. In the study, it went down to 0.33%. Okay. Now, what was the effect of this then? Well, I want you now to turn to page... Okay, the next page, 251, okay? So 254, look at the post-study statistical analysis. Okay. And under the post-study, just at the bottom of page 251, the first line, you'll see as no patients were lost to follow-up, they actually had additional studies, additional patients. So in fact, the power of this study actually was up to 85%, and that means that the this applied to not just 80%, but applied to 85 times out of 100. So that's even better. But now I want you to turn the page and look at page 252 under discussion, and the second paragraph down, you're going to see that it says the present study has some limitation. First, it is conceivable that despite the pre-study power analysis and inclusion of a relatively large number of patients, the lack of a significant difference between the two groups with regard to the rate of dislocation was a result of a type 2 statistical error. Okay, we believe this is unlikely given the increased statistical power and the post-study statistical analysis. And then they went on to say that in the follow-up study that they, of 1,000 patients, just looking at them, that the dislocation rate was less than 1%. So we're back to less than 1%. But basically, when going back to that very first question that was asked, okay, this study, the purpose of this was is to show, was there a difference? Not that there was no difference. And in fact, when they came out with this study and showed there was only 0.33, there wasn't a difference between a 1 and 3%, it was only 0.33, that basically showed there was no difference. So that could be a type 2 error, okay? And you will have another sheet in your handout, actually, where somebody's actually discussed that this is a possibility, although it is very highly unlikely.
Okay, so the summary is, look to see if there's a power analysis. If there's a power analysis, you feel much better about things, okay? And if they go on to explain it in the discussion, that's the take-home message from this, okay, with subjects. Okay, so I'm looking at the time, and I'm thinking, oh, do you want to address that slide?
Oh, no, just this was way back in 1994, and it has improved a lot. Out of 383 studies reviewed, and 70 showed no significant differences. Only 36, the big thing was that only 36 of these studies in 1994 had a power size enough to detect a true difference. So a lot of these studies, people will tell me, okay, yeah, using a posterior walker is just as good as roll later because this study just says that this is effective. But in fact, it could be, the message is, it could be that it wasn't a large enough sample size. So check that there was.
So sample size, power, that's what you want to read, okay, in the methods. Okay, outcomes. How about how they measure things? I'm just going to go through the questions now, okay, because I know that we're probably going in a little bit lower on energy. Okay, we're not going to go through these sections now. Okay, we won't go back to reading the paper because we have to move on through the rest of this information. Okay, so in the outcomes, were they clearly described? Were they detailed sufficiently for replication? Could you repeat it? That's what you want to know. Was the frequency of the outcome measures described at 3 months, at 6 months, at 12 months? Did they tell you when they took it? Were the measures relevant to clinical outcome? You know, does it make sense to you that that's what they measured? Did they talk about the reliability? So, if I measured range of motion and Joan measured range of motion, we know there would be a difference in what our measurements would be. Okay, was that addressed? Okay, did they check Joan and I before the study even began what the reliability, inter-rater reliability was between us, inter-rater reliability, okay? And within myself, if I tested 5 people, what was my intra-rater reliability in those outcome measures? And did they talk about validity? Did they say this is the gold standard measurement for this particular outcome? Okay? If you only have one outcome measure, it's a bit of a problem, because if that shows not to be statistically significant, you're just getting one data point out of, you know, you've only got one point to rely on. If you have related measures, like let's suppose you would expect that, for example, in this case, range of motion, ability to do stairs, walk, timed walking distance, etc., you would expect them to be related somehow. So that if one measurement went down, you would expect another measurement that was similar to also go down. So look when you're reading the studies to show that they've got more than one outcome measure and that did it follow an expected pattern. If one went down, is another one that you would expect to go down, did it also go down? Okay? Did they blind the evaluator, mask or blind the evaluator? So is the person who took the measurements, did they know what group the person was in? The subject was in, and was there any recall or memory bias? If patients are asked to fill out, which they do in this, their satisfaction, it depends upon, well, how positive do I, can I remember this from 2 months ago, 6 months ago, etc.? How did I feel about it? We know that there's recall bias. Okay, Maggie, short-term studies.
Okay, and the other thing is, look at it to see, isn't it a short-term study, is it a long-term study? So in this instance, I mean, the fact that 6 months they were better, all you can say from this study is that at 6 months, the outcomes were better. You don't know at 2 years, is there a bigger incidence of dislocation or not? So the short-term study, you can't infer long-term efficacy, okay? And many of the outcome measures do need a longer duration to decrease the confidence interval.
Which we're going to talk about now.
No, okay.
Okay, so everybody stand up and stretch for a second, because we can't pound in any more information without a chance to get some information stretched out of you. And you can stand for as long as you wish. If you wish to go and stand by the stairwell or the back wall or whatever, feel free to do so. Okay. What about the intervention? Was it described in detail? Could you replicate it? Was it relevant? So in this case, they decided that there were some precautions that they would keep for everybody, and there's some that they wouldn't keep. So the abduction pillow was one that only some people got. Okay. Who delivered it? Were they trained? Were they blinded to what was happening? Was the frequency appropriate? Was the setting appropriate? Let's talk about contamination and co-intervention in a little bit more detail. Look, another peeing slide. Contamination is where some of the control group receives the intervention. What did you say happened in this study?
They could choose to have some of the equipment.
If you were in the control group and you really wanted the equipment, you could have it. That's called contamination. Okay? Co-intervention is where the intervention group also receives some other care which can impact the outcome. That didn't Well, it might have happened, but we don't know, okay? Was there more than one therapist? Right, and does the impact of different therapists result in a different outcome? So you just sort of start to think of those kinds of things. In the results, did they provide you with the statistical methods? Remember we read that, blah, 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 blah. I want to give you a 3-slide summary of the key take-home Cole's notes. If I see this term, what does it mean? How relevant is it? And what's the strongest evidence, okay? Were they appropriate and were dropouts reported? This is really important. If 20%, in fact, the take home is 15%. If more than 15% of the subjects dropped out, there are serious issues there. What you should see when there are dropouts, because there will be situations when there are dropouts, is that they also analyze the results of the dropouts. And that they analyze the dropouts in something called intention to treat. If those people went through with full treatment, what would those numbers look like in comparison to the group that did receive full treatment? Okay? We'll go through this in a little bit more detail now. So it's important to determine what was done with their data. Was it excluded? Were assumptions made for missing values? Was it analyzed separately? Take home message. They should report how many dropouts there were. Remember, there were none in this study. Okay? Totally unusual. Okay? I can't tell you, this might be the first paper in 20 years that I've read that there was no dropouts. And believe me, I've read a lot of papers. They should do something called intention to treat analysis if there were dropouts. It reduces bias, and basically it analyzes all the patients together, okay, to see, was there something unique about this group which would have affected the outcomes? So all you have to know. I want to talk about these terms, okay, as far as results. We talked about the mean. It's just the average. It's really affected by extreme scores. So I don't like reading studies that only report means. I also like the median, and I also like the mode. Okay, I like to have the whole range of it. Okay, and the standard deviation, that just shows, you know what we mean by variance? How much skewing there is. Okay, so you want to look for more than just the mean. You want to have an idea of how those numbers are distributed. That's the take-home message there. What about when you read these things? Now, normally, the aversion, as soon as you read a statistics section and you read t-test, Kruskal-Wallis, something like that, you go, ew. And you close up the paper. I'm summarizing it into one line for you. Do they say that there was parametric or non-parametric tests? Parametric means that, and these are examples, t-tests and ANOVAs, that the population was normally distributed. It means that they looked at that particular outcome measure, and if they graphed that outcome measure, that it followed a bell curve of normal distribution. So all you have to read is, and you can write this in your note, tested for normalcy. If they tested for normalcy, then they can use a parametric test. If they didn't test for normalcy, then you really question, your radar goes up as far as the strength of the evidence. Okay? That's the take-home message. Did they test for normalcy? And if they did, you can relax a little bit and turn the page onto the discussion. Okay? Yes, question.
Does it matter if the distribution curve is
If the distribution curve is not normally distributed, then they have to use a non-parametric test.
Okay.
And these are the most common ones you see. Okay?
Okay?
So that's the take home. That's all you have to know about that part of the statistics. Okay? There's a couple of key terms that I think are critical to you understanding in the analysis. First of all, remember, a p-value is just a probability. It is not an indication of accuracy. P-values, papers that just report p-values, are a thing of the past. We have moved on in this world. and we have higher standards of expectation. There's something called a confidence interval. So I don't just want to know that this was the data point. I know that that's like a mean, okay? It just gives me 1 point, it gives me an average. I want to know how high it went and how low it went from there. What was the variation? That's what a confidence interval is. It means, what is the chance that we will find that same outcome in 95% of the population? It's a better indication of accuracy. So, you feel good when you see a p-value and a confidence interval. That's the take-home message. Yes?
Is a p-value related to the confidence?
Yes.
So they give you both, right?
Like right, but if you only get a p-value,
then it's not as strong.
Then you don't know. It's like a mean.
Right.
Okay? So you want confidence intervals,
okay,
to go with it. They might give you something called an odds ratio, and that just compares the probability, again, between an event for two groups. This is what it means. If it's one, if they say the odds ratio is one, it's equally likely in both groups. If it's greater than one, it's more likely in the first group. That's the take-home message. That's all you have to know about it. Is that clear with everybody? Yes, Sandy.
The only point is that if you're looking at an older article, it's not going to have a confidence
yes.
interval or
yes, but now they do. And the more meta-analyses and systematic reviews, you will see them. That's why I'm bringing it up. So this is what it looks like. So the confidence intervals, there's the, if we look at this slide now on confidence intervals, there's the p-value. And let's look at some of these lines. Let's look at the one for cardiopulmonary, the second one for cardiopulmonary versus the first one for lung cancer. What do you notice about those two lines?
One's in the middle and the other isn't.
Okay, one's in the middle, one isn't. What else? Is this a shorter line and a longer line? Which would you be more confident with? What would a shorter line mean? More confident. It's called a narrow confidence interval. The narrower that value, the more confident you are in the results. Okay, so that's what a
code
narrow
blue,
confidence
CCU,
interval is.
Code blue, CCU.
There's
code
two
blue,
more numbers
CCU.
That you may see that are more common now. One is something called a relative risk, and that's the probability that it will occur in one or the other group. It's similar to the odds ratio. Okay, except that it's divided by the total number of patients. Take home message, just look at this little summary slide. You just need to keep that, right? Just keep these notes, and when you read relative risk, you'll have an idea of that. Even more interesting, how many people, hands up, have read a paper recently with the number needed to treat? Did you know what number needed to treat was? I didn't until relatively recently. It is the number of people who would need to be treated to prevent the event of interest.
Can you give an example?
Pardon me?
Can you give an example, please?
Okay, so if they said that the number needed to treat for the inhalation, for preventing, taking a, well, we won't take a drug. Give me a clinical example, PTOT. Rojo cushions for management of skin breakdown, okay? That the number needed to treat was 20 versus 200 with the Rojo cushion versus without the Rojo cushion. It's telling you that only 20 people would need to be treated with a Rojo cushion in order to find one that wouldn't get the condition versus 200 people would need to be treated with a Rojo cushion in order, okay, I'm not explaining this very well. Back up, back pedal, put it another way. Sorry?
I said drug example.
A drug example,
though.
Okay?
It's much easier.
That you would only, 20 people would need to take a vasodilator to prevent an MI versus 200 people needing to take that drug to prevent one MI. The smaller the number, the better the result, okay? You wanna say that less people would need to be treated to get a positive result. I explained it much better at the end, didn't I? Yeah.
So sorry, because I'm an OT. So if I go back to the Rojo and a foam cushion or something.
Yes.
Then
if the number needed to treat for Rojo was smaller than the foam.
You're gonna have like 10
Yes.
Out of 100 as opposed to 100 of...
No, it would be one number.
Oh.
It would say the NNT for Rojo is 10. The NNT for the foam was 100.
Okay.
So you'd say, oh, okay, I'll pick the Rojo. Okay?
We're talking about the effectiveness of treatment.
We're talking about preventing.
Preventing.
Okay?
So
okay.
Only 10 people have to be treated by the wrong
correct.
Preventive SOS.
Yes.
100 people have to be treated with the wrong preventive SOS.
You said it even better than me. You can
say
do next. Next. 10 people would need to be treated with the Rojo to prevent a sore versus 100 people need to be treated with the foam to prevent one sore. Okay? Fail-safe number. This is something you're going to see in meta-analyses. It's really cool. It's a really cool number. You see a fail-safe number in a meta-analysis and you're happy. It's an estimate of the number of unpublished studies that would need to be published to find an opposite effect to refute the findings of the current study.
Yeah.
So, for example, I read an article recently on laser and chronic cervical neck pain. And it was a meta-analysis that pulled together RCTs of various studies. The number needed to treat was 42. 42 more studies would have to be published to show that it was the opposite effect.
Yeah.
To refute it. To refute the findings.
So higher is better.
So higher is, no. Higher is worse. You'd say 500 more studies have to be published. No, it's better. You're
it's
right.
Better. Yeah.
It's better.
Yeah.
Yes.
Higher number is better. Okay, so basically if you're going to see 42 studies have to be published versus 500, it's better if it is 500 more studies have to be. Okay? Regression equation. This doesn't mean we've reverted back to some primal state, but basically what it's saying is it's trying to allot percentages of different factors. So remember algebra, so much of x plus so much of y is equal to c, okay? Okay, so ax plus by is equal to c, okay? So let's suppose x is, and y are two factors, such as how much of wound development is because of moisture, and how much of wound development is because of body weight. What a regression equation is it figures out how much is A and how much is B. What is the effect of it? Okay, so you can say 10% of wounds are caused by moisture problems and 70% of wounds are caused by body weight problems. Okay, it allots a percentage contribution. Suffice to say?
I do it a slightly different way. If I can show
okay, go
way.
For it.
Go quickly for you. I use it a lot of times, and it just increases the power of the study. So here's how I use a regression slope. And I'm looking at it in terms of pulmonary function. And it depends on the day of the person, because some days somebody's feeling good and their pulmonary function is 100%. So it's here, and then the next time you come in and they're on a certain treatment, it drops down to here. And then the next day, and then another time they come in, so you're doing multiple, it's where you're doing multiple numbers over a certain time. So this is time on the bottom here. And so if we're doing over time, if you draw in those top like this, how can you make sense out of this? So what the regression does, it does by the mathematics, it actually draws a line through this, and actually this here would be slightly down here, and it shows a trend, a straight line.
A best fit line.
Best fit line here. So it actually equals out these up and down here in a regression line compared to another treatment where it may be that they went down here, but then they went up here, and then down here, and then went up here. So you, when you go like this here, then your regression is up like that. And so over time, you can say this is minus 2%, and this might be plus 3% a year, and it gives you a much better fit. Yeah.
Okay, so mathematical equation
yeah.
to describe the best fit of a line through data points
so,
that are not
mm-hmm.
linear.
Okay.
There's two other things that you'll see now in systematic reviews, okay? And I wanted to show you that. One is called a forest plot, one is called a funnel plot. This is the forest plot. They'll put the confidence intervals for a bunch of studies, odds ratios and confidence intervals. They'll put them all together. It's just a graphic representation. So you can say over 10 studies, there's a favoring of treatment. It's putting all the results together. It's like a systematic review. Graphically, you can see it. Look at something like that. You don't even have to look at the numbers, right? When you're looking at the results section, just look to say, oh, if you had equal distribution to favors placebo as to favors treatment, you'd go, you know, is that really any good at all? Versus a much better distribution towards favoring treatment. Is that clear? Okay. Last one, a funnel plot looks at publication bias. If you see a funnel plot, all it's showing is if it's equal on both sides, if it's symmetrical versus asymmetrical. If it's asymmetrical, you know there's some bias. That's the take-home message. Okay? Conclusions. You're almost there. You've got 3 minutes to go. Talk about the whirlwind. The last thing you look at is, did they look at the clinical implications? Were they reasonable? And did they report the limitations of the study? You ask yourself, can I apply this to my patients? Were the patients in this study similar to mine? Were the clinically important outcomes considered? And were the treatment benefits worth the harm and the cost? Okay, so that's the last part of your worksheet. So we can tie ourselves in knots trying to appraise critically papers. But if we have selected our papers well with our PICO question and with our limits in our search strategy, and then we just go through systematically answering those questions, and that's obviously not something you're going to do for every article. I mean, there's no way in the world you're going to do this for every article. But it starts you thinking about what is the level of evidence, what is the strength of that evidence, okay? Then we can actually have joy in our lives. Because we've figured out the key, the strategy to making this all work. There's other resources that you can go to for more information and practice on these. But most importantly, I suggest that you either join or start a journal club and use a worksheet like this to practice going through the articles. Because Joan, PJ, maybe you can say we're doing this at Providence, and we do it every month, and it gets easier every time, right? Yeah, you better say yeah. Because it's always much more fun with a friend. Okay, that's it. I'd like just to introduce Sandy for 1 minute to talk about what the plan is for the next session.
So we're going to give you a little homework assignment for those of you who are coming back in January. The next session is January 11th, same time, same place. And we're going to ask you to put into practice what you've learned with Allison over the last two sessions. So you have a PICO question that you've worked on in your groups, or you can make up your own new PICO. Go do a search. Find out what articles you come up with from that search. Pick one that you like. If it happens to be a physio-related article, you can send it to Allison. If it's an OT-related article, you can send it to me. We'll put our email addresses up on the board for you. And we'll pick an article and use it next time for our practical session, where we're looking at quantitative research articles. Qualitative is coming up, so hang in there. But January is looking at quantitative articles. Good question. If you could have them to us by the end, what did we say? December
22nd.
22nd.
And then, because there's Christmas in between. No, it doesn't mean you have to do it. We're giving you the option, rather than us picking the article for OTPT. If you want to put your practical, your skills into practice, you can do a quick, try your PICO, try your lit search honestly. It shouldn't take you more than 15 minutes, okay? You find an article that you think is useful, send it to us, we'll distribute it to the group. We'll look at the articles, make sure that they're reasonable to do in a journal club kind of situation, and we'll do that. You don't have to. Nobody is going to chase you up. Christmas will still occur. Santa will still come. But we just think that we want to give you the opportunity that we're not imposing it upon you. Let's put it that way. Okay? So if you want your article to be picked, then you better get it to us. Okay.
And the early date also, so we can look at the articles that you're sending us and then send it back out to you in time for you to read before the next session.
Yeah, that's fine.
So you'll be sending it back to us on the 10th.
We have a promise to send it out to you before the end of December.
I'll think about it.